extend a very warm welcome
to Judge
Kavanaugh,
to have a meaningful
his wife,
hearing
Ashley,
on the nominee.
Their two daughters.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris. Mr. Chairman,
Judge
we received 42,000 documents that we haven't
and everyone
been able
else joining
to review
us
last
today.
Night, and we believe this hearing should
I know
be postponed.
This is an exciting day for all of you here, and you're rightly proud
Mr. Chairman,
of the judge.
If we cannot be recognized, I move to adjourn.
The American people.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn.
Directly from Judge Kavanaugh.
Democrats doing what they could today, trying to delay the start of confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court sat and listened while Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, and others complained at length about access to documents from Kavanaugh's time in the George W. Bush administration. Republicans weren't having it, of course, and there were protests.
So, Judge, I'm glad you're here today. I'm sorry you're going to have to go through some of this nonsense that's about to come your way, but I hope you do it well. You're smart. You're smart. And you're a fundamentally decent, good person. Anyone who actually knows that to be true. Now, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that the committee should have to put up with this type of insolence that's going on in this room today.
Well, the insolence, as Senator Orrin Hatch puts it, is not without reason. If Kavanaugh is confirmed, as expected, he has the potential to reshape the nation's highest court, cementing a conservative majority that would likely last for decades. So, if there ever were a day for our legal to be here to opine, this is it. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi there.
Hi there.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's take the Democrats' opening argument here about access to documents. Just a little bit from Senator Patrick Leahy here.
Countless documents that have been provided to the committee contain apparent alterations and omissions with zero explanation. No court in this country, certainly no court that I ever argued cases before, would accept this as a legitimate document production.
Okay, Democrats complaining, A, they didn't get access to lots and lots of documents, and B, some documents were dumped on them 15 hours previous, just right before the hearings began. Do they have a point?
They do have a point, because when it comes to a incredibly consequential lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, who would want all the background information that you could? So what has happened here in some ways is entirely predictable and precedented, meaning Democrats who are in the minority and realize that Judge Kavanaugh, when he becomes Justice Kavanaugh, will reshape the court, as you said, for decades to come, are fighting back. And the midterms are coming, and they're fighting back with every kind of power that they have. But some of this is unprecedented. And for instance, the Senate Democrats did send a letter to the Senate Republicans on the Judiciary Committee saying, we have a real problem here. And you talked about these 100,000 pages of documents that are not being turned over. But that's not even the full story here. So Judge Kavanaugh famously worked for the George W. Bush White House, and he worked in two different capacities, in the White House counsel office, and that's the documents we're talking about with respect to executive privilege, but also as staff secretary for George W. Bush. Now, Senator Chuck Grassley, the head of the Judiciary Committee, didn't even ask for any of the documents related to his time as Judge Kavanaugh's time as the staff secretary. So we don't have those. We're just fighting about the documents that are related to Judge Kavanaugh's time when he was in the White House counsel. And specifically what we're fighting about is the documents that relate to his work on federal judicial nominees.
So these are the nominees that President Bush put forward, initially Harriet Myers, and then Samuel Alito, and then John Roberts.
And all of the lower court judges. And so we have a kind of interesting and opaque way that these documents have been held back. So these are George W. Bush documents in the sense that these documents were produced under his presidency.
So it's his executive privilege that's being invoked, not President Trump's?
No, that's where it gets kind of confusing. So it is George W. Bush has hired an outside attorney, and this attorney has been going through the documents. But then this attorney consulted with the Department of Justice, who consulted with the White House. And the attorney basically then sent a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee and said, As it turns out, we're going to withhold a lot of documents, about 100,000 pages worth of documents, because President Trump may assert executive privilege over them. And so that is what Senate Democrats, I think, are very appropriately saying is entirely unprecedented. And not only that, it will go unchecked.
They're not getting these documents.
They're not getting these documents. This train has left the station.
Okay. Well, so speaking of train leaving the station, it looks like he will be confirmed after all the theatrics that go on during the rest of the week. It seems like he's got the votes, correct?
Yes, particularly because the Senate has changed the rules for how you need to confirm a Supreme Court nominee, and now you only need a simple majority, and there is a simple majority of Republicans.
Okay, so once he is confirmed, barring some kind of crazy, who knows what's going to happen by the end of the week, but barring any unforeseen event, let's talk about executive privilege. He has written and talked a lot about it himself and has come to differing conclusions over whether or not a president can invoke executive privilege, whether or not he can be compelled to testify or should be compelled to testify. So what does that mean when we are looking at this independent investigation of President Trump?
Yeah, so many people have pointed out it may not be a coincidence that a president who is involved in a criminal investigation is nominating someone to the Supreme Court who has been one of the most open advocates for saying that the president should not be indicted. And there may even be questions about whether or not the president can be subpoenaed. And so people are saying basically President Trump is trying to pick his own judge here. And now, what we do know is that Judge Kavanaugh has written a law review article in 2009, and it's nuanced, but he's essentially arguing for the idea that the president should not be subject to criminal indictment. And he feels so strongly about that that he says Congress should pass a law. Now, there is no law. So in the confirmation hearings, he'll say, look, I was working as a legal scholar. That was my view. There is no law at the time. And we're going to hear from Judge Kavanaugh over and over and over again once all of the speeches end, when we finally do hear from Judge Kavanaugh. We're going to hear him say versions of exactly what Chief Justice Roberts says. I'm an umpire. I just call balls and strikes. I'm a neutral arbiter. I've not made up my mind on any particular issue related to any particular law, which is, of course, the height of irony, because when it comes to candidates running for president, what they say throughout the entire election is, don't worry, I'm going to appoint someone who is, if it's a Republican, really conservative, or if it's a Democrat.
So it's inherently political.
It's inherently political. So right up to the nomination, we pretend this person, we know exactly how they're going to vote on anything. And then the moment they're nominated, we say they're a blank slate.
All right. So quickly, he will replace Kennedy, who was considered the center. He's much more conservative than Kennedy was. Who is now the center of the court?
The center of the court is now Chief Justice John Roberts, a sentence that I did not think that I was going to utter when Chief Justice John Roberts was nominated and confirmed to the bench. And so some people are thrilled by this. What do we know? We know that a Chief Justice has not been the center for about 80 years. We know that there has not been this consequential of a Supreme Court nominee in over a dozen years. So what we're really doing here, something we haven't done for the last few nominees, we've been kind of trading liberals for liberals, conservatives for conservatives. Now we're trading a moderate conservative for a conservative, conservative, conservative. And he will solidify the court on issues like LGBT rights, affirmative action, abortion rights, criminal justice, particularly when it comes to death penalty, where Justice Kennedy was more circumspect. So there is no indication that Chief Justice John Roberts will suddenly become a moderate conservative. This will be a very conservative court for decades to come.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as you can tell by today's Kavanaugh hearing, the fall political season is officially open. For the next 2 months, a lot of attention will be on the November midterms. A new Washington Post ABC News poll finds that Democrats have a clear advantage in House races. 52% of registered voters say they'd vote for a Democratic candidate in their district. Only 38% say they'd vote for the Republican candidate. That is a 14-point gap. Scott Clement is the polling director at the Washington Post. Hi there.
Hello. Good to be here.
Great to have you. All right. When was the last time you saw that kind of gap in favor of the Democrats?
Well, it's been quite a long time, though. They're fairly close to where they were in January and last fall. In January, they had a 12-point margin on this generic party support question. We saw that shrink in April to 4 points. So it has been up and down this year in our poll and in others. Generally, because of the way districts are drawn, Democrats are thought to need somewhere between 6 and 8 percentage point victory in the overall House vote in order to flip enough seats to win control of Congress. So they're certainly in that territory.
Right. They need to pick up 23 Republican-held seats to flip the control, right?
Exactly. And rather than in 2016, it's a very different territory, right? These are more suburban districts. These are districts that are a little bit more white than the rest of the country. Our poll is really, of course, nationally. So what we're really catching is overall dynamics of the race. What are voters thinking as they are about to consume a more intense campaign?
What are they thinking? What's driving them?
Well, in a word, Trump. Trump is center to vote preferences in our survey. More than 8 in 10 people who approve or disapprove of Trump either vote for or against his party in our survey. And that's on par with some recent elections, which have really served as referendums for Presidents George W. Bush and then Barack Obama in 2010 and 2014. And that's tough for him because his approval ratings are not in good shape. He's at 36% in our survey approving and 60% disapproving. So it's a rough place to go.
Yeah. But on the other hand, he's got super high approval ratings among Republicans, right? Like in the upper 80s, 90 percentiles?
He does. In our survey, it's right around 8 and 10, so a little on the lower end of that. But he clearly maintains strong support among his base. Trump is important as a motivator for turnout, both for his base and for Democratic opponents, which suggests that his participation in the campaign, endorsement of candidates, plays a bit of a double-edged sword for him. So he may motivate his fellow Republicans to vote because they want to support his agenda, but Democrats are also really fired up to come out and oppose him. In the middle are independents, of course. They're a real hodgepodge of Republican and Democratic leanings, but they favor Democrats right now by 18 points. In the last few recent midterm elections, they have been critical.
Does it then reside with the independents? Are they the key in many of these districts?
It matters a lot. They're important, and we've been watching them very closely over the last year and a half or so, and they really never saw clear majority approval of Trump. And it's not clear they're moving in his direction, which is a trouble sign. The other big one is enthusiasm. Fewer than half of Americans tend to vote in midterm elections. We do see people a little more interested this year. In 2014, Republicans had a big advantage when asked whether they're certain to vote in our polls. It was 10 percentage points. This year, it's flipped to Democrats by 6. So it's always a mix of persuasion among those independents as well as turning out their base. And Democrats seem motivated this year.
Well, what is the enthusiasm? Because, as you say, that's often a good predictor for how these things will go in the midterms. How fired up are Democrats? How fired up are Republicans?
Sure. So just to put numbers on it, 75% of Democrats say that voting in this year's midterm elections is more important than voting in previous midterms, 75% among Democrats compared to 57% among Republicans. So they have an advantage on that. And then when they're asked if they're certain to vote, 80% of Democrats say they are versus 74% of Republicans. One thing that's really a counterintuitive factor, and we don't know how this really will play, is positive ratings of the economy. People tend to give the president a break on controversies when the economy is doing well. Just 20 years ago, our polls were asking about the Monica Lewinsky scandal ahead of the 1998 election, where Democrats actually gained some seats. 58% say the economy is excellent or good. What we're seeing, though, is that Trump Republicans aren't getting full credit for this. Nearly half of people who rate the economy positively still disapprove of Trump, and that's the real best predictor of whether they're voting for Democrats or Republicans. We don't know how that's going to play out in the fall campaign fully, though.
Well, what is it that they disapprove of?
Well, we didn't measure a variety of approval issues for Trump in this particular survey, as opposed to the economy or other issues. But we have seen that people are a bit more approving of his policies than they are his personality. We see the sharpest negative reactions to things like on immigration or his views of the way he handles racial issues. The economy has always been a bright spot on that. Here, 45% approve of him, 47% disapprove him on handling the economy. Either way, I think of it as the economy and then sort of all the other issues that are accommodating a variety of issues and controversies Trump has been criticized for. And that seems to be playing a big role. Whether Republicans can convince voters that are satisfied with the economy that they should reelect Republicans in order to keep that going is really what we're going to have to see over the next couple months.
So when Republicans are looking at the results of your poll, would it behoove these candidates to try to distance themselves from Trump and his policies and not try to go for the so-called Trump bump?
You know, it's an interesting strategic question you're asking, and it's also one that they may not be in control of. Trump is so front and center to these campaigns, and Obama was in 2014 and 2010, that while candidates in those years tended to try to separate themselves, they really couldn't do a great job. Just keeping on Obama in 2014 when Democrats lost a lot of Senate races, Democratic candidate was able to outpace his approval rating by more than 9 percentage points. Call that the local benefit factor. And a lot of senators lost that year. Republicans may be facing some of the same things. The other thing is that Trump isn't really running away from his own candidates, and Republican candidates aren't running away from him. So some of that may be reinforcing this referendum factor, where people are thinking really in lines of whether they want more of Trump or whether they want a check against him.
So it seems like it's all pro or con Trump. For the Democrats that are fired up, do they see a positive reason for going with the Democrats, or are they just saying, we want to vote Democratic because we need to get rid of this guy, we don't like Trump? Are they saying we actually like the Democratic Party and our candidate?
No, they're not. Certainly not. 51% say that the Democratic Party is out of touch with the concerns of most Americans. That's down from early in Trump's term when two-thirds of Democrats were out of touch. So they're improving on that measure. But overall, still a lot of doubts for the Democratic Party. We saw this, too, in previous midterm elections that turned out to be waves. It's not a requirement for voters to really like the party out of power in order to render a strong verdict, though, for president. Republicans maintain low approval ratings despite winning big swings in congressional seats in 2010 and 2014. So it's important to watch, and certainly speaks to Democrats' mandate if they do flip the House, whether it's an endorsement of their own policies or really just a desire to pump the brakes on Trump's.
That's Scott Clement of The Washington Post. Thank you.
Certainly. Thanks.
Coming up, Facebook and Twitter go before Congress tomorrow. What executives of big tech will likely hear from lawmakers about election security and bias against conservatives? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. All right, we're going to talk politics and technology now and preview some upcoming hearing room drama. Tomorrow, Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey will be in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. The topic, what tech companies are doing to protect the upcoming midterms. Expect to hear lots about Russians and bots and shadow bans and how conservative voices say they are shut out of the debate. David McCabe writes about where tech and politics collide for Axios. Hi, David.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, everyone seems to have an axe to grind with big tech. So what's going to happen tomorrow? What are some of the highlights?
Well, you know, this is sort of the pencils down moment, like that moment when the teacher says, put your pencils down, you have to turn the test in for these companies. And so they're coming prepared with answers about how they are trying to protect elections and how they say they are unbiased platforms. And that'll be joked both in the Senate Intelligence Committee in the morning and also in the House Energy and Commerce Committee in the afternoon for Jack Dorsey. He'll be testifying there as well.
Okay. Jack Dorsey is especially, well, I guess, under the microscope from all sides. Seems like nobody is happy with him. So what kinds of questions do you think that he'll receive?
From the right, there will absolutely be questions about this question of, you mentioned shadow bans, which is this idea that maybe conservative voices are being limited in more under-the-radar ways than just outright bans, and the larger allegations of censorship that I think the president was sort of seizing on last week. On the left, I think you'll have questions about InfoWars and Alex Jones and his decision to keep some of the more bombastic, and they would say, violating Twitter's policies, voices on the platform. And I know for a fact that he will likely get questions about this story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that he may have personally chosen to keep Alex Jones on the platform. That's something that Twitter denies, but it's pretty likely, based on our reporting, that lawmakers will ask about it.
So what was the explanation in that story of him personally wanting to keep Alex Jones on the platform?
So, again, they have denied it. They've said that they enforced their rules consistently, that there wasn't some sort of special treatment here. He, though, has been fairly adamant that Twitter is a platform that tries to be open to a wide range of voices while complying with their rules in terms of safety and hate speech. And so his public position has been that Jones, at least for a time, could stay on the platform. They obviously took some steps to look at InfoWars later on. But certainly it's a really contentious topic and a lightning rod for him.
Right. And so I guess they're trying to walk a thin line here because they don't want to invite any really overt government regulation on their products, right?
You know, I think that's right. I think that they are all thinking about what government regulation they would be okay with. And I think one thing you'll see maybe in the Senate particularly is some lawmakers coming in and saying, okay, where would you be okay with some sort of regulation or guardrails? You know, ad transparency is one area that's been discussed. Potentially labeling bot accounts is another. So that's one thing to watch, is what these executives say they would be all right with in terms of regulation.
All right. And what about the upcoming election? Are they getting help from the federal government to fight off foreign bots and, you know, adversaries who want to plant fake news?
They say they are working with law enforcement on these issues, with the national security apparatus on this issue. But that's actually something to watch, because in the past they said they weren't getting the support they felt they needed. And the companies have also been working together. Facebook has been hosting these meetings with other Silicon Valley companies to look at some of these questions and share what they're working on and how they're working on it. And so I think we'll see that continue and maybe even pick up going into the fall.
Right. But the White House eliminated the role of cybersecurity coordinator, right?
And I can't speak to how that position exactly impacted the relationship with these companies. I think that we're absolutely seeing them try and work more proactively with law enforcement. Generally, obviously, it's a very large intelligence community working on these issues.
Right. But they have said that, or the law enforcement community has said, Dan Coats has said, the DNI, that the lights are blinking red, right? I mean, that interruption or interference in this election is happening now. And so is there any indication that Facebook, Twitter, any of these social media platforms are prepared or willing to prevent that from happening?
You know, I think we've obviously seen them all disclose some recent activity akin to what we saw in the lead up to the 2016 election, though not exactly the same, somewhat more advanced. They would say that they are taking steps to do so. And obviously, they've instituted some ad transparency databases, although that varies from company to company how exactly that works. And they say they're taking more steps internally to build up their teams that spot these potential malicious actors sort of before they can get these campaigns rolling. But I think we've seen that obviously some have been active on the platform. And the pressure is just going to grow as the midterms approach. And in the end, I think that's the real test. There's still several months to go, or a couple months to go, before they're in the clear, at least in this cycle.
And how are they doing financially?
Well, you know, Facebook suffered a pretty significant loss after its last earnings report. That was seen in part as a factor of their investment into some of these issues, that it was cutting into their margins. And I think that underscores something really important, which is that the biggest risk for these companies is that this becomes a business problem. Regulation is something they know how to deal with, they know how to influence. But the idea that growth could slow down is something that this Wall Street is very wary of and that has freaked investors out.
David McCabe writes about tech policy and politics for Axios. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, how a tech billionaire's whim could end up rewriting California law that grants public access to the beach.
This is someone whose drive for perfection could reshape coastal policy for, you know, 1,100 miles of California coast.
Vinod Khosla doesn't even like to swim, but he does like to win. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Venture capitalist Vinod Khosla wants people off his beach, and he's willing to spend a considerable amount of money to make that happen. He does have billions of dollars at his disposal. He's been pursuing the issue in courts for about a decade, but the courts have so far not been kind to him. They say Khosla is violating state law by trying to restrict access to his beach. So now he is trying to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. Well, Khosla didn't just buy a beach. He bought a whole beach village. It's just south of Half Moon Bay up in Northern California. He hasn't even spent a night there. He doesn't own a home on that beach. Nellie Bowles spoke to Khosla about his campaign. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you covered him, or you read about him for the New York Times, and you've been trying for a long time to get an interview with him. Why was it so difficult to try to get him to sit down to explain himself?
I think he hasn't wanted this to define him, and he knows, kind of rightly so, that the narrative is hard to control on this one. I mean, you have these charismatic surfers and townspeople on the one hand, and then you have this somewhat secretive billionaire on the other hand. And so I think he was probably wise to not be doing a ton of interviews about this, but I've found his quest to be fascinating and strange and kind of offensive, because I grew up in California and believe very deeply in public access to the beaches, which is enshrined in our Constitution, of course. But I've just found Vinod to be a fascinating character. Mm.
So tell us more about him. He's the co-founder of Sun Microsystems. And
yeah, I mean, this is a man who built the consumer internet. This is a man who built Silicon Valley and whose influence is enormous, and who has been really a hero to the left for many years because of his investments in green energy and in eco-friendly technologies that he really believes in.
Yeah, and so he buys this beach, Martin's Beach, with these 47 cottages and one defunct little tiny shop that doesn't sell anything. Why did he buy it in the first place?
You know, he bought it more or less on a whim. He thought it was beautiful. He liked beautiful things. He bought this little village. Families who've been living in these houses for, you know, generations. And he wasn't really sure what he was going to do with it. I think he thought it was going to be a lot easier to manage and to maybe eventually turn it into a giant beach house or a hotel or something like that. I don't think he totally realized how ornery the Californians can get about their beach access.
Right. And so he basically said, what, you can't come on this beach if you don't live in one of these cottages?
The family before him had been running it as a sort of small business where they charged $10 for parking. And you could park along the beach or in a lot nearby, and then you go on and surf. And what he did was close the gate and say that he's no longer operating this business, this parking business. And the parking business had been losing money. And so, but by closing the gate, of course, then he closes off the beach and surfers can't go anymore. And then he, at one point, had armed guards up at the top, and then at one point, some surfers were arrested, who became the Martin's Five, which was, again, a public relations disaster. So he basically said, the state is trying to force me to run a money-losing operation, and I shouldn't be forced to do that. And so he wanted to be able to close the gate.
But he has so much money. Why does he care if it's a money-losing operation?
Well, that's kind of the question, and that's what makes him such an interesting character, right? He's got $2.8 or around $3 billion, something like $3.2, I don't even know, somewhere around $3 billion, right? And his mind has kind of gotten stuck on it because he really believes in principles and I know it sounds crazy, but like he really genuinely believes that it has to be done right and it would set a precedent if he didn't do it right, and that like the state can't compel him to do what is not right. And so for the profile, what I wanted to really show was how this fits into him as a person, how this fits into the other work he does and into his personality. And so I went to his office where he's built this sort of obsessively perfect space where he designed everything from the paper towel dispenser in the bathrooms. He picked out every bulb for every flower. He picked out the grasses. And to show that kind of this obsession is not just about the beach, it's about like a broader thing. But whereas a lot of people are eccentric and a lot of people have obsessions or want things to be perfect, this is someone whose drive for perfection could reshape coastal policy for you know, 1,100 miles of California coast.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so that is really the nut of it, that his whim, it might turn out to be really far-reaching for the whole state and everyone who wants access to some
and
of these beaches.
And he doesn't even totally want to win. That's the best part. He just, he can't not fight it. In his mind, he knows he's right. He can't not pursue it, even as he tells me he hopes he doesn't win.
He hopes he doesn't win at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well,
he is being represented by Paul Clement, who is a heavy hitter, who's argued many cases before the Supreme Court. So there is a good chance he will win.
Yeah.
If they take the case. We have to say
idea.
They haven't decided to take the case.
What the bettings are here. But it really is just such, to me, it's such a California story.
So describe exactly what they're arguing or what they're trying to argue, why they're trying to convince the justices to take this case. What is the constitutional issue at the heart of this? In their minds.
Okay, so what they're really battling over is this one rusty old gate at the top of the road and whether or not he needs to apply for a permit to change the hours that that gate is open. He wants to close it all the time. The Deeney family who owned the property before him had it open for, you know, X number of hours per week. And he's arguing that the state can't compel him to leave a gate open or even can't compel him to apply for permit, that it doesn't even need to be permitted. And he's doing that on three amendments. And he's, basically saying it's a private property issue and also sort of a, he's arguing on First Amendment grounds as well, that it's a freedom of speech issue in a way.
Basically, he could just apply for a waiver and get them to agree to open it at different hours or go
sort
through a different.
I mean, so this is a very narrow case in that. Yes, it's about this one permit. But more broadly, the state of California has taken moves to make it so even if he wins and he doesn't need to apply for a permit or whatever, California has now signed into legislature language saying that it is willing and ready to pursue eminent domain to sort of claim that road. And so then they would start a negotiation over price. But it's both very small because it's just about this gate, it's just about this permit, and much larger because obviously just as the NODCOSA is deeply entrenched and unwilling to compromise on this and unwilling to stop this fight, the people of California are not willing to stop this fight. It'll kind of stretch on indefinitely.
So here's a guy who, just to summarize, bought this village. He hasn't spent a single night there. He doesn't even swim or like to swim.
Yep.
He doesn't want to win his case before the Supreme Court.
A great character.
Like, he is a great character. He lives in a purple lair. As you described.
He loves the color purple. Yes.
But there's nothing that can shake him from his belief that he's right and that he needs to win just for the principle of it. But does he not think, okay, it's not worth it? The ends do not justify the means.
In his mind, no. I mean, in his mind, there is sort of a cosmic battle happening, and he has to play his role in it.
And so does he care about his reputation? Because now he's lumped into the bad billionaire
category.
Exactly,
and that's the thing. He doesn't. He doesn't care. Like, that's kind of one of the most interesting things. Everyone else who has tried to do a beach battle, because every generation of billionaires tries to do a beach battle. They want a private beach.
Oh, we have David Geffen
who
here
doesn't?
In Southern California.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Typically, the playbook is they get shamed in the public, they get dragged through lengthy court battles, and pretty soon they kind of give up. And they throw in the towel, either they're embarrassed or the court cases are too onerous, whatever. This gets to be exhausting, and they stop. And the thing about Vinod is because of his personality, which is, since he was a kid, has been this sort of obsessively principled personality, he just won't stop. He can't stop. And so it doesn't matter the public shaming. It doesn't matter how long or how annoying the court cases are, or how small it gets. He's right here for it. And what was interesting is I talked to some of his partners at firm, and they actually said that it's been somewhat helpful in their business negotiations because they can use this and say, listen, if someone's trying to screw over their firm or in a deal, they can say, look, Vinod Khosla is not going to back down. He is fighting a 10-year battle for a beach he doesn't even go to. And so it kind of has made him a mythological figure in the valley.
Well, what's also interesting about him is while he's doing this, trying to shut off beach access to, you know, surfers or whoever wants to go to the beach, he also has some pretty publicly minded ideas. You write that he wants to come up with a way to 3D print homes for the homeless and put them above parking garages. So he does, he does think about the public good.
Yeah. I mean, what I love about this story, and like all the best stories are, it's complicated. There is no hero. There is no villain, right? Like, he is just a very complicated man figuring out his own sense of a moral code and trying to live it in a very extreme way.
So should and, the... Yeah.
And we're all kind of at the whim of it a little bit.
So should the Supreme Court take this case?
Yeah.
And should he win? What does that look like? What does that mean for the rest of us?
It could reshape coastal policy in a very real way. And the sort of lawyers and historians that I talked to said this could be one of the biggest threats to California's sort of deep and fundamental protection of public access to the beaches.
All right, Nellie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Nellie Bowles. She covers tech and internet culture for the New York Times. Coming up, the pro football season is upon us. Which of the two LA teams should you root for? The Sklar Brothers are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Okay, you know what that means. Time to talk sports. Nike stock took a little dip today. Pictures are circulating on social media of people cutting the swooshes out of their socks and setting their Nike shoes on fire. Wow. That's after the company revealed its new ad campaign starring Colin Kaepernick. Politics, they've come to the NFL. Here to talk about that and more are the Sklar Brothers.
How
Randy
are
Jason
you?
Sklar. How are you guys?
Nice to be back.
It's been a while.
Well, politics have been in the NFL for a while
I guess
now,
so.
Mainly because of Colin Kaepernick, but in a great way.
Yeah, to refresh for those who don't know, I mean, he was one who wanted to figure out a silent, a peaceful way to protest police.
He was the first one who kneeled,
police
right?
brutality. Not the flag, not against the troops, and he actually got with a Navy SEAL and said, what's the most respectful way that I can do this? And the Navy SEAL said to him, he has an Instagram photo of him standing with a Navy SEAL with his hand on his shoulder as Colin Kaepernick is kneeling down and not saying anything, just kneeling in protest. That was devised with a military person, and somehow that has got twisted. I wonder how, in this political climate, into you hate the troops, you hate the flag, you're disrespecting our flag. And that's not what it was. And so,
I mean, it's almost like drawing a blue stripe on the flag where a red stripe would be.
I mean, who would do that? Anyway, so the owners then sort of jumped on this bandwagon as Trump has just been hammering the NFL in tweets. And the owners sort of got together who
they
are.
They said, we need a new law. We need a new rule of law within the NFL, which is now. The new rule is if you want to protest,
you can do it in the locker room.
Go in the locker room.
Where no one can see you.
Right. Right. You're not allowed to be on the field if you want, which is also somehow almost a larger way of protesting the anthem itself. You're not even listening. You're saying, I'm going to take myself out of the field. So that was what, and a lot of teams don't know how to deal with that.
And even the Cowboys, Jerry Jones, you know, a good friend of Trump's and a billionaire many times over. He spent $16 million on the party after his Hall of Fame induction. $16 million on one night,
wow.
One party. He also is not paying his cheerleaders, FYI, you know, because he's crying poor. But that's a whole other story. But the point is,
on a party.
You got to spend on the party. I mean, why not $16 million? But he said that all of his Cowboys are going to stand for the anthem and nobody is going to be in the locker room.
What
You're
happens
coming
if
out.
They go into the locker room?
His
then?
Son, who is also a member of the team, said, you will be off the team. You will not be long for this team if you don't honor the flag this way. Jerry Jones also photographed with a hat on during the national anthem. That's not respectful. And he wouldn't take it off.
It's a thorny issue that Colin Kaepernick brought up. And, you know, not that we want to stand around and applaud Nike for, you know, making him the face of a new ad campaign.
We do want to stand around and applaud Nike because at the time now, companies are kind of either staying silent or moving very far right because they're afraid of the backlash that's going to happen. As soon as Nike said Colin Kaepernick is going to be the face of one of our future commercials or campaigns, I was like, just wait for the country music singers who are going to make a video of them cutting the Nike swoosh out of their sound guy's socks, because that's happening. You know.
So what is Nike's calculation here? Because the stock is down today. And so are they thinking, well, maybe we don't need football fans as much as we need basketball fans or other people around the world? What?
I think they're thinking we don't need everyone. If we can galvanize the people who support Colin Kaepernick, because there are millions of people who do support Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
If we can galvanize those people and they bank on those people buying shoes. I mean, an interesting thing has happened in the last couple of years in the shoe market. Adidas has sort of taken over Nike in a way that it hasn't been that way in years. You know, Adidas with their shoes, the NMDs and the other popular shoes, as far as streetwear and what the young people are wearing, Adidas has sort of stepped into the game and stepped up to Nike.
Maybe this is a way to say, hey, we're a socially conscious company. And is a way for Nike to say that. It could be a bit of a lost leader, which is fine. We're not getting to the business of it, but you know, for Nike to take a stand at this point, their stock's down a little bit today, but I would see that. I would imagine it'll rebound.
So meanwhile, Kaepernick is suing the NFL.
And he just had a small victory in court, which the NFL wanted to throw that case out, saying there's no collusion. Again, where
have
we heard that before?
So he's saying the owners have colluded against
him.
To not hire him.
And, you know, from a football analyst side, you would say, yeah, obviously, he's more qualified than a lot of guys who got hired after he wasn't hired, quote unquote, hireable. A lot of guys have been hired with less good numbers as him, guys who haven't taken teams all the way to the Super Bowl like he took the 49ers to the Super Bowl. There are a lot of players who got hired.
When it should have been Kaepernick
when he was out there
in front of him. And you say to yourself, wait a minute, this just doesn't add up. You're watching it going, why aren't you taking Colin Kaepernick? That would be a great choice for a backup. Or, hey, your starter's down. Bring this guy in. He knows how to win, and he can make plays with his feet. He's got a great arm. You know, you're wondering yourself, why would you take this guy who's been out of football for a year and a half? You know, now Colin Kaepernick's been out for a while, but you took this other guy who's kind of washed up. And so it does feel like it reeks of collusion of some sort. The NFL wanted it thrown out, but the judge said, no, you can move forward and actually go with more discovery. So now owners are going to be able to be brought in and questioned in a courtroom setting. Why did you not choose him?
And he's got a powerhouse attorney, Mark.
He does. He definitely does. It's going to be hard to prove, but he has a strong legal team.
Okay. So meanwhile, the football season opens. Yeah, so how does this all play into that? And locally, the Rams' first game will be in Oakland.
Yeah, one of the last games that there will be in. I mean, Oakland will not be around in a couple of years. They'll be in Las Vegas.
Well, the
Las
city
Vegas.
Will be around.
I don't know
hopefully.
If Oakland will be around.
Will not
I don't
around.
Know if it'll be around, Jay.
It will.
Check your stats.
I will. But yeah, Oakland Raiders will be moving to Las Vegas and become the Las Vegas Raiders. But the Raiders are going to be great this year, and the Rams are going to be great. The Rams have added a lot of amazing players on defense.
All of them are a little fiery, have some personalities and have some baggage. And Ndamukong Suh is a guy who famously one time, he's been fined more than any other player in the last few years. I think almost $300,000 for bad plays, for roughhousing. He one time stepped on someone's neck.
After
a play. Which, how many people can you say have stepped on someone?
Like on purpose?
It was on purpose. He stepped on someone's neck. I mean, I think if you went to the Hells Angels, you'd find maybe three people who have stepped on a neck. And you're saying to yourself, okay, this is like when Sammy Hagar went to Van Halen. You're like, yeah, he had his own thing going, but Sammy Hagar may have stepped on someone's neck. I don't know.
No, but
you're making tequila
You're saying Sammy Hagar is a neck stepper?
I don't know.
No, but we're saying when you brought him into Van Halen, did that make them better? Well, it made them better than when they were with the extreme guy.
Gary Cherone.
But with David Lee Roth at the beginning.
All right, anyway, we're going too far astray here. But the point
only
is that, like,
one,
the
David
point
Lee
is
Roth.
They brought in Aqib Talib, who is one of the best
defensive backs
out there. Aqib Talib one time shot himself in the leg, which is metaphorically like shooting yourself in the foot.
Yes.
Except higher up.
Like he brought and then got nailed for the gun and he got suspended for a couple of games. I mean,
but he has 30 interceptions in his career and 10 interceptions returned for a touchdown,
which is third best all time. So now you have him on your team. So they've upgraded at certain positions. But the question is,
Mesh?
Did you mess with the chemistry, which last year we had a great chemistry. Yeah. Here in Los Angeles, and that's what a lot of people said. That's why the team went so far in the playoffs and made the playoffs and got a bye.
The other thing is, last year there were no expectations for the Rams going into the season, and then they went all the way to the playoffs and they did great. This year, people are saying, wow, this coach is great. He's a young coach, but he's great. The team
make it to the Super Bowl.
They should. Some people are saying Super Bowl, but definitely they should make it to the playoffs. So anything short of the playoffs will be a disappointment.
How do they play with expectations? That's always the test in sports, because a lot of sports is right between the helmet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the Chargers?
Sure, the Chargers are going to be great, too. Chargers are in a great division. That's another Los Angeles team. Although Randy and I always think maybe they need to call themselves the Southern California Chargers, just to maybe differentiate a little bit.
SoCal Chargers.
But the Chargers are they're a great team. They did well at the end of last season as well. They kind of started off weak, but then they had a great finish to last season. They're in a division where a lot of teams
are telling you right now, I can't tell you who's going to win that division. And four games in, they've got the Raiders, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Chargers
and the Broncos
and Denver. I can't tell you who's going to win that division.
Who
I really
want to win.
Well, obviously, it would be great for LA if the Chargers won.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Broncos have recently won a Super Bowl. The Raiders have something to prove. It's their last year in Oakland.
They have a new coach, John Gruden, who's amazing, who came from ESPN, the analyst position, to jump back and be he's the last guy to take the Raiders to the Super Bowl.
I'm going to say Raiders because you guys have said Oakland's not going to exist.
No.
Well, look, you're playing for the existence of the East Bay. You might as well do it.
Okay. Sklar Brothers, Randy and Jason, check out their audio documentary. It's called Sklars and Stripes on Audible. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
All right, Christian Bordell's here with some feedback. Hi.
Well, I asked listeners what they think about this whole Colin Kaepernick Nike thing, and it was pretty one-sided. Everyone is pretty supportive of what Nike is doing. Catherine Lydon says, I don't buy things with a label or logo on them, but I'm going to this afternoon, probably just a pair of socks, but a small gesture to thank Nike for using Kaepernick. Todd Ubbin says, I have no problem with it whatsoever. Colin has stood up for minorities and brought needed attention to abuses of power within our law enforcement ranks that continue to go unpunished. I applaud him for that, and now applaud Nike for supporting Colin. And Louis P. says, I'm an Adidas kind of guy, but as of today, I'm buying my new favorite, Nike. It goes on like that. So wow. a lot of support there. I was also kind of curious, you know, how LA football fans are dealing with the fact that we now have two teams, and the Rams are going up to play the Raiders, which
no
also...
No one's playing in Inglewood, by the way.
No one's playing in Inglewood, not for a couple of years yet. So I just asked, you know, like, what team do fans support? 32% of LA football fans say they support the Rams. 5% support the Chargers. Only 14% support the Raiders, which I was kind of surprised by. So that's where things stand these days in terms of...
Well, the Raiders aren't... They're not exactly homegrown.
They were here for quite a while.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bordell. And, just a reminder that we are in our UnDrive Pledge Drive.
I didn't even mention it.
I know.
It's so on.
It's so under the radar.
It is.
But basically, we're basically not pitching, except a little bit right now. But we just hope that you'll do the right thing and become a member or renew your membership at 800-600-KCRW or kcrw.com. And note that we're doing this. It's a big experiment to not cut into programming or change or shorten any of the programming that we usually bring you, especially during these crazy, heady times. So if you appreciate that, please, we need you to do your part. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.